variety of people. Welcome, and I hope you'll join us in the future as well. Okay. Well, 6 o'clock. Are we ready, Mike? This evening, we're privileged to have Kevin Sullivan, who is the director of the White House Office of Communications. And you came what month last year?
July.
In July.
About 8 months.
And
When I got there, I was 6'5", 180.
Yeah, and beating you down, huh?
No. Just kidding.
He has a varied background. Last week we had Scott McClellan was telling us how he got to the White House, and his route was through politics, that he had known the president for a long time because his mother, Scott's mother, was in politics, and so he worked through the political world. Kevin comes to the White House from a different background, and I want him to talk about his background and then also talk about what that's brought and how it has helped you deal with the White House, with issues there.
You know, I started my career in sports public relations. I worked for the Dallas Mavericks for 18 years from the time I was, you know, right out of college. Went to Purdue University, worked in the athletic department there as a student. Always knew I wanted to do something in sports. I ran out of, you know, athletic ability and talent, and so I ended up in communications. And I think in sports, most people end up in sports communications because they love sports, not because they dream of being a communicator. So it's sort of funny how it works out. It's almost like, you know, yeah, what can I do? Well, I guess I could do this. This doesn't look that hard. So you end up, you know, in public relations. So I was with the Mavericks a long time. You know, I moved up through the ranks. By the time I left in 2000, I was the VP of communications. I oversaw broadcasting and the charity foundation and some other stuff. But I had a great run there and was hired in February of 2000 to go to NBC Sports in New York. Moved to New York, was there 5.5 years, the last 6 months of which I was on the corporate communications side after the merger with Universal and following the Athens Olympics. I shifted from sports to corporate. And was only in that job a few months when I feel like it was sort of an alien abduction in the middle of the night. A woman I had never heard of named Margaret Spellings, who had been the president's domestic policy advisor in the first term and had just been sworn in as the Secretary of Education, through a mutual contact, called me one day and asked if I was interested in meeting with her. I can't describe how little interest I had in the U.S. Department of Education, any of it, moving, government, politics, no interest. And then I made the mistake of meeting her for lunch in Alexandria one Saturday morning in February of 2005. And she leaned over the table and said, I don't know what you'll do after NBC, but this will be the most important thing you've done so far. We have important work to do. We don't have a lot of time. I'm putting together a great team. It's going to be fun. Your family's going to love it. You should do this. And I was just sort of, you know, kind of blown away. But I really liked her. She had this gleam in her eye that she wanted to accomplish important things. And I just sort of got caught up in it and eventually passed the background check with the FBI, which was touch and go. Just kidding.
Especially hanging out with all those sports people.
That's right. And so all of a sudden, you know, I'd spent my whole career in sports and entertainment, and, you know, now all of a sudden I was in the federal bureaucracy. And there are more similarities than you would think, but there are some differences, which we can talk about if you want to. Make a long story come to an end, I was there 14 months and got a call from Dan Bartlett in June of 06, just asking me to come to a meeting, and next thing I knew I was being interviewed for Nicole Wallace's position as communications director. The ultimate irony, because when Secretary Spellings was trying to convince me it would be a good idea to move from New York to Washington, one of the people she had me meet with was Nicole Devenish at the time. To talk about what it would be like to be a member of the administration, and never in a million years dreaming I would end up at the White House. So I would love to be able to tell you I had some master plan where this was all laid out, but it wasn't that way at all. I just answered the phone, really, and here I am. And the thing that impressed me during the interview process, Josh Bolton, who was still fairly new as the White House Chief of Staff, and others that I think I interviewed 9 times before I eventually got the job, they were really eager for new ideas and for an outside perspective and a fresh, you know, set of eyes. And it really did, I think, play to my advantage that I was a little bit of an outsider, and I did bring a different perspective, as a guy that had not been immersed in campaign work in the administration for a long period of time, just long enough to kind of know what was going on. Obviously, Secretary Spellings, having worked in the White House in the first term and worked for President Bush when he was governor of Texas, it was almost like going to finishing school for a year. I was around her, I got a lot of the White House perspective kind of through her eyes, just kind of by osmosis. So, and I think it has been a good thing that to have that different perspective.
Tell us what kinds of things are valuable lessons from sports that you bring into the White House.
There's lots of similarities. You have winners and losers in sports and in politics. You have reporters on deadline. You have breaking news at all hours of the day and night. There's lots of nights and weekends. You have crisis communications like crazy all the time. Players getting in trouble, arrested, trades that aren't popular. But the number one similarity, I think, Martha, without question, is, in all those years I worked for the Mavericks, we were really a part of something. The staff that worked there, you really rode the roller coaster, the wins and losses, the good years and the bad years, the good nights and the bad nights. And so that there was this camaraderie with the staff. And the same is really true at the White House. You're there because you believe in the cause. Everybody, sports and politics or government have this in common, too, that you could almost for sure make more money working somewhere else. Sports is not known as being the highest paying place for communications because there's so much demand. So many people want those jobs. You tend to find you could probably make more money doing something else. So you do it for the love of the game or the love of the cause. And in this case, at the White House, just like at the Mavericks, you really do find a team of people that do believe in the cause and believe in what they're doing. And I think sports really does have that in common with the political environment where you believe in the candidate or you believe in the president.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us something about the similarities of crisis communications, of how a crisis rises up, what its parts are, and how you deal with it? And is it similar in those two worlds?
They're different in a few ways. But if you go to a crisis communication seminar, usually the first thing they tell you is pick one person to speak on the crisis, make sure it's somebody who's credible, and then you go through how you establish what your messaging is going to be, and you tell it all, and you tell it yourself and tell the whole story right out of the box and all that sort of thing. Well, in sports, they're really at the opposite ends of the spectrum in some ways, in that the access to the president is very much, by definition, has to be somewhat limited. Well, in sports, you have a locker room that's open. There are rules mandating when it has to be open to reporters. So when something happens that thrusts you into crisis mode, you've got a team owner, a team president, a team general manager that you can sort of get on message. You have a team coach that is less, easy sometimes to get on message, but you sort of can. You've got four assistant coaches. Now you have 15 players in the case of the NBA, 12 active players, usually two or three guys on the injured list. Well, you can't go into that locker room, really, and tell those 12 players what to say. Well, you can't tell them not to talk. So in terms of managing the message when a crisis happens, it's almost impossible to really, nail down, especially, I've been out of the NBA since 2000. Imagine today if you're a football fan in Dallas, you're not gonna be able to manage what Terrell Owens says about a topic, on a given night or a given week, very effectively. He's gonna say what he wants to say, and that's kind of the nature of the game today. Mm-hmm. So in terms of managing the message, it's probably easier, even though it's never easy. It's probably easier in an environment like the White House where there is a structure, and there is usually a communications plan. Now, you can't manage the Hill, and you can't manage, the members of the Democratic Party, and you can't, there are other ways where it's out of your grasp. But that locker room environment is awful tough to manage.
Uh-huh. Tell us... Can we take a particular crisis and apply a lesson? Let's say that Ron Nessen, who was press secretary under President Ford, said that every press secretary knows what you need to do, that you need to gather all the information and you need to bring it together, bring the people together, and then and give it all out. And that everybody knows that. You could say that in the communications office too, and you're talking about that in even in sports. But that generally doesn't happen. I mean, things just go out in dribs and drabs.
Right.
And you look at the whole U.S. attorneys issue. I mean, that thing has just been kicking along, you know, for, it seemed like, weeks. What is working against just getting all the information of how the guys were fired, what all the elements were, putting them together and giving a briefing and saying, this is how it happened?
You know, the president has said, you know, he wishes it were handled more like the way you just described, because we don't have to go through the necessarily the substance. We can talk about the communications aspect of it, but that's a case that it clearly should have been handled better from a communications, you know, rolling out that issue. You know, you make a determination that you're going to make changes with eight U.S. attorneys, which is certainly the president's prerogative to do, and they had served, you know, their full terms, and it was in the hands of the Department of Justice in order to manage that rollout, and it got off track, kind of on their end in the early stages, and never really quite got put back on. And we're hoping that, you know, when the Attorney General goes up to Congress week after next and talks about it, that it will once and for all be laid out. We've been kind of managing it ever since.
Uh huh. You know. It's a problem that it's difficult to get information coming up, you know, to getting a full story.
Yeah, and I think Kyle Sampson, the former chief of staff, has talked about that he didn't share the whole story necessarily on the front end, and that became the problem. The way that, you know, he was in charge of managing the process as asked by the Attorney General to do that, and yet didn't necessarily when department officials went to testify to Congress. There were questions about what they had been told before they went, and that was improper. So, mm-hmm. So you know, we ended up in a deficit where we really didn't need to be.
Uh huh. One of the elements here, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, was a story in Politico, where the author, I think it was Mike Allen, said that several people were being considered for the Attorney General's spot. And that the White House was interested in getting somebody else. Now, on that kind of leak, which the president knocked down, on a leak like that, is there interest in trying to find out who leaked that? And were they working against an overall plan? Or do you just not deal with it?
You know, it's a case-by-case basis. I mean, in that particular case, I'm not sure the particulars on that particular uh-huh. case at DOJ. But, you know, when information gets out that shouldn't have gotten out, you know, I think depending on how important it was, and we could talk about rapid response a little bit around this too, but, you know, depending on what it was, you want to look into it, find out how it happened so it doesn't happen again. And sometimes it's against the law, depending mm-hmm. on what was leaked, you know, and how it was leaked. Was it classified? Was it something that, you know, that should not have been out?
Uh-huh. One of the things that that you have done in your office since you came, like it started earlier, but it certainly has picked up steam, is a rapid response operation where you send out emails to a pretty far-flung list mm-hmm. of people, from talk radio producers, anchors, people on the Hill, people in the administration, reporters all over. Tell us what some of the elements of that rapid response operation is.
You know, somebody told me early on in my career, that talking about dealing with reporters and how to manage news stories, you know, you're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. And so the rapid response operation is really designed to take something that's inaccurate, just plain wrong, not something that we disagree with, but something that's wrong or misleading, and try to stop it before it becomes part of conventional wisdom, just accepted as being truthful, especially in the with the media cycle being the way it is now and blogs and everything else. If you don't get something quickly, it really will become just accepted as conventional wisdom and as something that's true. So rapid response is it sounds like it's a defensive thing to do. We're responding to something that's already out there. But, and I've explained this to Martha before, we look at it as being on offense, you know, that we're not just going to sit back and allow something to seep into consciousness that's wrong. We're gonna go on offense and rebut it. And but the tricky thing is you got to pick your spots, because there's nothing worse than you know, that barking chihuahua in the middle of the night that just won't shut up. And if you blast out emails in response to every article that doesn't completely align with the administration's viewpoint, you won't be taken seriously. You lose credibility, and after a while, you're just tuned out. So what we try to do with the rapid response operation is, with documents like MythFact, is probably the most popular, the best example. When, especially if it's a big story that's sweeping or really general, you pick out four or five things that are wrong. You say, you know, here's the myth and here's the fact. Sometimes we do it, we just call it setting the record straight. It's never personal. You know, it's not done based on who the reporter is. It's based on what's in the story. Sometimes we do the rest of the story, where there's nothing that's really inaccurate in the story, but it's incomplete. And so you say, well, here's what was in the story. And you have to be careful not to call more attention to the thing that was wrong. So you have to evaluate how much play did this get? How much traction is it getting? And so here's the rest of the story. Sometimes and we have other documents that are, you know, we have a morning update every day that kind of has some clips from overnight, a little bit about what the President or Mrs. Bush are going to do that day. So there's sort of an array of documents at our disposal that we try to get out. But it's not like a spam operation. It's not, you know, people imagine there's, you know, 100,000 people on this mailing list. It's a couple thousand. It's administration surrogates, you know, communicators and policy people at the various agencies, reporters, talk radio producers, bloggers, other interested parties, you know, and it's been pretty effective, you know, I would say. Sometimes more so than others, but, you know, people do notice it and ask about it, so.
It seems that with a reporter is the subject of a setting the record straight, that they don't appreciate it.
It has been noted. You know, there was a press conference not all that long ago where Jim Axelrod of CBS, who's a great reporter, in a question to the president, made a reference to the last May having been the subject of a setting the record straight. So, you know, it obviously was still on Jim's mind, uh-huh. You know, several months later that he brought it up right. In a press conference with the president. Probably the best example, and Martha and I have talked about this also, when the Bob Woodward book came out last fall, and the first installment was excerpted in the Washington Post, and on the inside double truck, you know, jump from the front page beginning of his excerpt, right in the middle of the excerpt was a Reuters article about the MythFact document that we had done on the book. So when the book came out, we literally, you know, we got a couple of copies before it hit the stores, and devoured it quickly, you know, kind of divvied it up, and were able to respond to a few key points, and so that was in the coverage. So when you were reading that excerpt, a couple days before the book was out, you were able to read the five things that the White House thought were inaccurate, and then when Woodward went on his book tour, we had a number of examples where reporters, particularly cable news reporters, would say, "Well, the White House says that." It didn't happen this way, it happened that way, or whatever. So that was extremely effective, I would say.
Mm-hmm. What generally do you think is the outcome of that kind of effort?
You know, it just gives us a chance to get on the playing field. You know, mm-hmm. I think that's the idea, to try to, again, not let people, obviously, you know, again, as I said a minute ago, you want to try to stop things from being accepted just as conventional wisdom, or as being, you know, 100% true, when they may be, it may be a little bit, there may be something in there that's just not right that causes it to be misleading or incomplete.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us, that's one aspect of your job, running that operation. Can you tell us what your roles are as a communications director?
You know, no two days are ever alike. You know, I really have been very blessed. I've had these great jobs. You know, the Dallas Mavericks, NBC Sports, NBC Universal. Working with Secretary Spellings at the U.S. Department of Education was a blast. Yeah, I never went into that thinking that I went into it kind of believing in her vision, but it was more fun than I ever thought I would have working at the, you know, in the government. This job is, you know, I can't begin to showing up at the White House last July, especially not as this longtime kind of political guy, really was like stepping onto a speeding train. And one day I was with the president on a trip to Mississippi and New Orleans a couple of weeks ago on a Katrina trip. And on the way back on Air Force One in the conference room, the USA Today was sitting there, and I almost absentmindedly I picked it up and I was kind of flipping through the front section of the paper. And I started to realize that we were on almost every page. And I stopped and I counted 14 stories that we were in one degree or other had our operation had been involved in, some more than others, but 14 stories. And that's the thing that's so amazing about it is, in fact, 5 or 6 weeks after I started, I went to lunch with George Stephanopoulos, who's been enormously, he's a great guy, and it was really helpful to me in my early days, you know, as sort of a newcomer to Washington, and, you know,
And he held that job.
He held that job, yeah, which was,
beginning,
you know,
of the Clinton administration.
And if you haven't read his book, you know, it's amazing, about, you know, about just sort of working at the White House but anyway, he said to me, I was never as smart as I was when I worked at the White House. And it's really true that, you know, the things that you have to learn in order to be able to brief the president on a topic or to you know, like, you know, 1 minute it's, I remember one day, I didn't know what E85 was. This was like my second week on the job, you know, and it's ethanol. And I'm going to brief the president prior to an interview with the Wall Street Journal about alternative fuels in Alabama, and it's like, I better learn this stuff, you know, before, obviously I have to know it, and there's ways to gain the information at the White House. There's experts on these things, but that's the thing that's so fascinating about it, is from immigration to education to healthcare to, you know, Gulf Coast rebuilding to all the Iraq stuff to the economy to, you know, it just goes on and on and on, the number of the things that you have to learn. So it's very stimulating, you know, kind of intellectually and but because of that, on any given day, you know, you may deal with, you know, when I was at NBC Sports, on any given day, I might deal with the Olympics and the PGA Tour or NASCAR or Notre Dame football or whatever was in season, and it was 3 or 4 things, but they weren't that complex and they weren't that different from each other, and, you know, so this is just sort of, you know, your mind just really does expand to the point where I'm beginning to think I'm forgetting things that I, you know, I used to know just, you know, a year ago or whatever. But no 2 days are alike. The pace is phenomenal. We start really early in the morning. I was not a night owl before I took this job in any stretch of the imagination. You know, I leave the house around 6 a.m. I get to the office between 6:30 and 7. Senior staff meeting is at 7:30, and in that meeting, you kind of get gone. And 8 o'clock, the communicators meet. And
can you back up a little before you've gotten to the White House? What have you read, and what have you listened to?
Well, before that 7:30 staff meeting, I've read the, you know, on a good day when I can get through it all, you know, I've read about 5 newspapers. You know, I've been online.
What are the newspapers?
You know, the New York Times, the Post, USA Today, the Wall Street Journal. I probably looked at the editorial page of the Washington Times and flipped through the front section of that. I've spent a little time online. I've looked at the front page of the Financial Times usually, and depending on the issue, you know, what's going on at a given time, that will dictate a little bit where my focus is. But the main thing will be, I'll look at the president's schedule for that day on one of these, you know, one of these little cards. You know, I'll make sure that I know if there's an, you know, what events are we doing today? What's the president going to be talking about? What is the message of the day? And you know, I want to know. I've got that down cold. That, you know, we're going to Hoover, Alabama, to talk about alternative fuels. Here's who's going to be in the meeting with the president. We're bringing along John McKinnon from the Wall Street Journal. Here's what he's going to, you know, ask the president about in this exclusive interview. Here's what we hope to get out of it. Why we're doing it? Because the president will say, you know, what's the message? Why are we doing this? So I better know what I'm talking about. So to learn, to have all that stuff kind of in hand by 7:30 in the morning for a guy who used to wake up at 8 o'clock in the morning is a big adjustment, has been a big adjustment. But it's very exhilarating. It's exhilarating and humbling at exactly the same time. So it's a bizarre sort of confluence of emotions kind of on a daily basis. I've only been there 8 months. I'm not a long-term, like Dan, 6 years, 7 years. I don't know how he's kept up the pace he has and maintained his good cheer, but he's an amazing guy. But I don't take for granted when I walk in the morning, I'm really aware of the obligation of working there and the responsibility that comes with it. But the people are amazing, and it's a great place to work, and that's what keeps everybody fueled, even in these challenging times.
When you go to the senior staff meeting, can you tell us something about how that meeting is organized and operated? What kind of information everybody has before they go in it, if there's anything that's common that people
have? I think everybody's probably looked at the paper, but the communicators, we have a greater responsibility to know because we're going to inform the message of the day and what everybody's talking about. But Dan is there, I'm there, and then Tony Snow would be there. Now with Tony out, Dana Perino is there. So the meeting starts with Tony, or now Dana, doing a – Josh Bolton, the chief of staff, runs the meeting. And the first thing is usually, what's in the news? And Tony or Dana would kind of go through the headlines. Here's what we're going to be dealing with today. Usually the next person to speak will be Candy Wolf, who's the assistant to the president for legislative affairs, and she'll give a quick readout of what's going on the Hill. And then after those two speak, we'll kind of whip around the room. And it's a half an hour. Josh runs a great meeting. There's usually one or two light moments, but generally speaking, it's kind of what's going on today. Is there a decision that you need on something? Are there any loose ends? I left out one thing. The meeting actually begins with the person who runs the president's schedule commenting on any late changes to the schedule, and then we kind of bang through the issues of the day. And again, the policy people will talk about issues that are percolating in their areas as we will go around, and then from there we go to Dan's meeting with all the communicators, which will include, the Office of Management and Budget communicators, and Mrs. Bush's press secretary, and the Vice President's press secretary, and our, a couple of layers down in the press office and a couple layers down in the communications office. And we all work very well together. It's a much flatter arrangement than you would find in the corporate world, I would say. It's kind of one big dog pile, and we get in there and help each other and kind of figure out what's important today, what are we going to be, dealing with. And again, what kind of documents are we going to put out today? What are we going to be pushing? What kind of, surrogates can we put out? What are the agencies doing? Sometimes more than others, but we try to make it a well-coordinated, linked-up operation. And, on Wednesday we talk about we get going on the president's radio address, which he records Friday morning. Usually on Wednesday we make that determination. The Sunday shows, Wednesday and Thursday, we start talking about who's going out on the Sunday shows. And again, the division between the communications shop and the press shop is really breaking news, the White House press corps, news of the day, and the communications shop is a little bit more of the strategic planning, longer view. We'll take a topic like an issue like energy or immigration or education or, healthcare, whatever it is, and we'll have a 2 or 3 week calendar, often longer, that we're managing around the president's events and speeches. And of course, speech writing also is under Dan's umbrella, and we're all kind of immersed in that world, too, in terms of, what should the president be talking about and what kind of audience and what kind of event and who with and all those sort of things.
Mm-hmm. Do people in the meeting, when you tell them what the issues are going to be that day, judging from what you read and what you hear, do they tell you what they want you to say, or do you tell them what is going to be said?
It's more like we're the experts. So it's, what do you think we ought to be saying about this? How should we be talking about this? And we're given a chance. There's a lot of smart people there, which is one of the amazing things about being in that kind of environment. But usually they will say, what do the communicators think about, what we should be doing on this? So we have a chance to, and it's one thing, and as you, kind of go out into your own careers, I would recommend that you think this way. I did this, at NBC as well. When you're in communications, you really are supposed to be the experts on how to communicate about something. So, I used to tell, I would tell our people, don't go to, Al Hubbard, the president's economic advisor, and say, we have this opportunity with CNBC or Bloomberg or the New York Times or whatever. what do you think we ought to do? Go to Al and say, here's an opportunity I think we should make sure that we do, and here's why. And here's why this is a good opportunity, what the message ought to be. I think we can, you know, drive things that way.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that other administrations have done a lot of, and this administration has not, is bringing policy people out to talk, bringing people into the briefing room. Say, in the Clinton administration, Henry Cisneros, who was the HUD secretary, and Donna Shalala, who was HHS, and Riley, who was education, used to come to the briefing room. If the president was doing an event, they'd come to the briefing room and talk about what the policy was that went along with it. And the stories that came out of it tended to be very favorable stories because they had a lot of meat to them. It wasn't just, you know, what the president said, it's also what the whole policy is and the explanations of it. And there's been really relatively little of that in this administration.
You know, I think we've done more of it recently. I think Steve Hadley has done more on camera mm-hmm. and on the record. He's the national security advisor. I think, you know, he's done some.
And
when we had the, I think
Condi Rice did too in the first term. She did.
The way we approach it is, if it's a really, really complex issue, like when all the last summer when the military commissions stuff was going on, which is a very complicated issue, you know, I remember General Hayden going over with Steve Hadley, Hayden being the on the intelligence end. And kind of going through that for the reporters before foreign travel. Usually, last week I know there was a policy briefing on before Secretary Rice's trip. You know, I think we've done it with on occasion, but it's, you know, it may be just a little bit of a difference in philosophy mm-hmm. where we've picked our spots a little bit more than making that a regular thing. We did it with the on climate, we made the EPA administrator available along with Secretary Bodman. Now, the briefing actually ended up taking place at the Department of Energy, but it was made available to the White House reporters. And, you know, so, you know, it's something we could probably take a look at to do more of as the issues mm-hmm. dictate.
Do you find that on complicated policy stories that some media are better than others? Like, for example, say on some health care issue, that it would be more to your benefit in getting the story across to give it to the New York Times, not deal with the whole press corps, give it to the New York Times, or say, like in dealing with North Korea, give it to David Sanger of
right.
the New York Times, because everybody's going to then take it from the Times, that television takes heavily from the Times.
Right.
And so for policy, complicated policies,
you know,
would use newspapers that way.
The Howie Kurtz's book, Spin Cycle, is one of the, I would also commend that to you as recommended reading if you want to know how this stuff works. And he, in that book, goes through the Clinton administration in great detail with the various tactics they used. And they were the thing that, when I was working at the Mavericks when I read it, you know, this was in the late 90s, I guess. And it struck me as they were the same kind of things we did at the Mavericks. And when I got to NBC, it was the same kind of stuff that we did there. And certainly, you know, one of the options sort of in your public relations or public affairs toolbox, you know, is going to one reporter who's going to give it a lot of space and talk to, you know, in depth about it and, you know, kind of give you that opening salvo, make it a big deal. They're going to play it on the front page. They're going to make it a prominent story if it's broadcast. And then the rest of the media follows, so that you get a kind of a second day of attention on that story. I think it's case by case. I think there are times when that's the best way to go. Sometimes when it is a really complicated, you know, policy matter that requires you to have that not sliced and diced, but more of a longer form take at something. So it really just depends on the issue. I think it's one that there are issues that works for, and I think that's been true. I think for years. And one thing that was fascinating, I hate to admit this, for my friends that knew me when I was cool working in sports and entertainment, but I listen to C-SPAN radio once in a while on the weekend. That's how much I've gotten into this, you know, Washington scene, I guess, Martha.
Mm-hmm.
And a few weeks ago, they were playing the LBJ tapes.
Yeah.
And there was a a phone conversation that they played between LBJ, who was in the White House on a Saturday morning, and Jack Valeni, who was one of his communications advisors, who was at home. And so there's this phone conversation, and they were talking about what's the message of the week going to be. And they were talking about an issue with a speechwriter. They were going to hire a new speechwriter and move this guy out of speechwriting because he didn't quite, you know, get it or whatever it was. And they talked about, should we do a speech or should we just have a meeting? And I was struck by, you know, this was, you know, 1965 or whatever it was. And you know, that could have been 2006 or 7 based on, you know. Mm-hmm. So all these things that we're talking about, you know, the speed has changed, and they didn't used to have blogs, and they didn't used to have, you know, a 24-hour news cycle. But a lot of it hasn't changed. I mean, some of the real basics really are tried and true and have been around, you know, as long as there's been, you know, communications.
Yeah. Because in large part, one of the things Ann Compton talked about, and she started at ABC in 1974, and we talked about the sameness of a story, that a presidential story has remained the same. You're looking for the same kind of information, even though your tools may be different.
Right.
And definitely the speed is different. The number of times you have to report is different. But what is news, what is important, tends to be pretty much the same.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that, and you know, and Ann is great, and you know, and she would know. The one thing that, you know, Dan Bartlett told me when I first got there, we talked about strategic communications. You know, in the Republican side of the world, you know, President Reagan obviously being viewed as the great communicator, and yet in his day, they really did kind of pick one thing to do for the evening newscast, and the evening newscast had these huge audiences. And, you know, they still have big audiences, and they still do amass a lot mm-hmm. of people, but it's not like it was in 1980. You know, mm-hmm. And so the pressures are different, and the expectations are different as a communicator for, you know, to how to navigate the news cycle as it's changed. But you're right. I mean, there are, you know, the same kind of trips the president goes on are this, you know, that some of that hasn't changed all that much, and the policy topics are more complicated probably, but there's still health care, and there's still Social Security, and there's still immigration, and there's still the economy, and there's, you know, gas prices, and, you know, those sort of things really are still the mm-hmm. There's a lot of similarities there in the issues several decades ago.
And there's also the similarity of, in some senses, of the relationship, that it's a cooperative relationship more than it's one of conflict. That each side needs the other. The president needs the press if he's going to get to the public. And
right.
News organizations need the president because he's so central to the concept of news of the readers and viewers.
You know, several weeks ago now, we brought in a series of the White House correspondents into off-the-record sessions in the residence with the president. And the idea was that, you know, we want them to know him a little better, and to learn, to get a little bit of access and a little bit of a glimpse into his thinking, because so much of their relationship is in, you know, in press conferences and in interviews where you don't have a lot of time. And I think it was helpful to do that, and they seemed to appreciate it. But he acknowledged that point you just made, Martha, that, you know, I want you to understand where I'm coming from, because we do need each other and we do have this relationship. And you know, the president really does enjoy the give and take and the back and forth, and I think that comes through in the press conferences when you see him joke around with David Gregory or whoever it might be in a given, you know, Ken Herman is another guy he goes way back with to their Texas mm-hmm. days, and it's not uncommon for the president to make some joke to Herman during in a press conference, but it's part of the job. There's no question about it, and you know, we all get along pretty well, and we respect what the White House correspondents do and the function they perform. And you know, one of the things that was a pleasant surprise for me, I didn't really know what to expect when I came to the White House. You know, you know, when you're sitting at home watching on TV, you see these guys doing these stand-ups in front of the White House, and what they talk about is so serious and so important, and there is conflict kind of embedded in it much of the time. I didn't know, you know, what as a group, were they going to be fun to deal with and travel with and work with on stories. And almost without exception, it really is a fun group, and they're smart, and they – you know, they've got tons of stories, and most of them are veterans on the beat. You know, some are newer than others, of course, but it's a lively atmosphere. It's more, you know, I tell my friends when they say, what is it like to work at the White House? You know, it is more fun than you might think, especially, you know, in the challenging times that we're in right now with the nation at war and everything else. It's a smart group that believes in the cause, that enjoys working together, you know, and it's a great environment to be a part of, and the reporters are part of that environment, and that give and take is a real healthy part of it.
What do you find the view is generally within the White House when you've had discussions about the press? What role do you see the press as having in this society?
Well, it's a crucial role. I mean, it gets to the very core of our democracy. We need them to function as a democracy, for them to do their jobs. And there's, you know, a free press is essential. And I think, you know, for the most part, you know, setting the record straight and rapid response included, you know, in the discussion, I think for the most part they're very fair. You know, and I think most of them go out of their way to be fair. You know, and so I think the relationship, while at times, you know, more so than others, it's a pretty good one.
Mm-hmm. Today, the president had a press conference where he had a session that it wasn't announced beforehand that it was a press conference, but I think everybody figured out that he was going to be taking questions. How do you decide when he has session with the press?
You know, it's really kind of almost done by feel. You kind of know when you need to get out there. Now, right now, we're in this, a pretty intense back and forth with Congress about the funding of the supplemental budget request for the war, and you know, we need to be out there, you know, every day. It doesn't have to be the president every day, but we need to be active and on the playing field, making sure our message is breaking through. And we felt like it was time. There was a natural opportunity in the schedule where the president had a meeting that was previously scheduled, unrelated to this, with General Pace, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and with Secretary Gates, the Secretary of Defense. So we thought, after this meeting, why not have the president walk out and make a statement? And you know what? It's probably about time for the president to take a couple of questions. We did the same thing after the U.S. Attorney's thing started to get a little bit, you know, off the rails. Let's have the president. We were actually in Kansas City doing an alternative energy event. We speeded it up a little bit, got back a half an hour early so we could make the evening newscast, had the president take a couple of questions after making a statement about the U.S. attorneys. The president taking questions on it adds credibility to it. It gives the media a chance to be more a part of it. It's part of the deal, you know, and we know that, and there's nothing the president can't handle in those situations. But the interesting thing that happened today was, you know, Dan suggested to the president, why don't you take, you know, a couple of questions, maybe even four or five, and it was the president's call. He ended up taking 12 questions, so it really was a full-blown press conference, although it was more informal in that they were standing there on the South Lawn instead of, you know, formally seated with a seating chart and all that stuff. But it was really more of a deal where we felt there's a lot of issues out there that we felt it was important to have the president's voice on. The Supreme Court decision yesterday on the EPA and the regulation of carbon emissions, U.S. attorneys, the most importantly today, the war supplemental, the Iran British sailors thing. I mean, there's a number of things out there that we thought, you know what, the time is right. So it's really done, you know, kind of based on what's feel and what's in the news, but it was the president's call to take that many questions and really turn what was a statement into a full-blown press conference. In fact, Dan said to me today afterwards when we looked at the questions, said, you know, 12 questions, Martha's going to count it as a press conference. So so we hope you do.
Yeah. But how did you prepare?
This was one, you know, the president doesn't need tons of preparation for a deal like this. But yesterday, we did a little Q&A, made it available to him at the end of the day. Not very extensive, just a little bit of a refresher on here's the variety of topics that are going to be out there. And then we met in the Oval Office, Dan and Dana and I, with the president for just a few minutes, just kind of reminded him, here's what's on their mind, you know. Very informal, very brief. fun, you know, a little banter back and forth, and it was just for him to take a few minutes, you know, to just to focus on, you know, kind of what he'd be asked. Uh-huh. Not unlike, you know, what you would do prior to a press conference if you were the VP of Corporate Communications at NBC or at Staples or University of Texas. You know, the same kind of deal.
Mm-hmm. When you say that it lends credibility, having the president respond to reporters, it lends credibility. What kind of credibility for whom, and how does that work?
Well, I think it just, yeah, I mean, the president is credible on his own. I didn't mean it that way. But what I meant was that by allowing the media to participate in that way, you know, you're probably going to get more, the coverage will be a little bit different than if the president only made a statement. I think that the television networks will cover it differently when it's a statement plus taking questions. I think it just adds another dimension that adds another layer to the coverage. Uh-huh.
One of the things that you all have done is put a lot of attention on local media,
right.
Regional and local media. What kinds of things do you do with them, and what's the benefit of it?
You know, it's funny. It's a great question. We spend a lot of time on what's known in Washington as the regional media. Now, if you live in Waco, and the Waco Tribune Herald, you know, is the paper on your parents', you know, kitchen table in the morning, to them it's not regional media. It's the paper they read. It's their hometown media, you know, and you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's millions of readers of papers that don't have a White House correspondent and local TV affiliates. So we pay a lot of attention to them. We have an operation called Media Affairs, headed by an amazing woman named Jeannie Mamo, who's from North Carolina, who spends her whole day, and she works about 15 hours a day or more. And what she does is she knows what's going on in Topeka and in Pensacola and in Spokane, and whether it's talk radio or the local newspaper, and she knows what issues are bubbling up there. And sometimes there are issues that are important there before they're important here, you know. And so for us to be able to, you know, kind of read the tea leaves that way and get ahead of stories, I think is important. And but we you know, I did a radio interview today. Did one to Yuma, Arizona the other night because the president's going there next Monday. You know, I mean, just to try to talk about what's important to the president in those markets and, you know, what are, you know, various policy decisions and other things. I think you miss the boat if you overlook the local markets, and we try to really, you know, stay on top of that. The president believes in it. He's done a lot of interviews with the regional TV affiliates. You know, if you do, you know, Tribune Media represents, I don't know, 15 or 18 television stations, whatever it is, you know, and I think you're missing the boat if you neglect, you know, those outlets.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take an example in local media coverage in a way what it comes back to. Early in the administration, I was in College Station, Texas, for a conference, and the president's energy proposal was coming up, and there was an article in the College Station Eagle right in the front page about it, and it was written by Terry Hunt of Associated Press.
Right.
Recently in Philadelphia, I went to Philadelphia, and there was I can't remember what the issue was, but right front page, Jennifer Lovin, who was Associated Press reporter. Even in India, I was in India in January, and there were some White House issues that were discussed in the Hindustan Times, and Jennifer Lovin was the person. So Associated Press, it was people who, before press got moved over to the conference center, I mean, they were people who were not 50 yards from the Oval Office, who were really the people in those local news in the local press who were writing. That in the long run, it's really the national press that you have to deal with.
In the national press, you know, sets the table and leads an opinion and drives national television coverage sometimes and all that. But there are also local columnists and syndicated columnists that aren't White House within the White House, you know, correspondence pool that are in tons of papers. So I mean, I think it's important to get them. You know, you said Mike Allen is coming in a, uh-huh. that would be almost a can't miss, because not only is he a really, he's a funny guy and an interesting guy and an experienced guy, but the notion of the Politico, you know, being almost a bureau that local and regional papers could tap into. You know, the Dallas Morning News has really downsized their bureau here, and they're using more the mm-hmm. you know, New York Times Wire and the and the AP and everything else, so that when you pick up that, you know, if you read the Dallas Morning News and the New York Times back to back on Sundays, so you're going to see a lot of overlap. So it's a little bit of a, you know, papers are becoming less local, you know, and that's an issue to keep an eye on. But I still believe that local columnist does carry a lot of sway in those markets out there, some of which are decent sized markets. So I think it's important to continue to keep an eye on them.
One of the interesting aspects of the Libby trial has been all the exhibits that have been put up and made available. If you all are interested in communications, there's a lot of interesting stuff that's up there. But one of the things that struck me in looking at some of Kathy Martin's notes is they were talking about what to do about the Valerie Plame.
Right.
Well, it was the Joe Wilson. What to do about the Joe Wilson piece. And so she listed a group of strategies. One of them was MTP, Meet the Press,
right,
and having Cheney go on Meet the Press, which is the one that ended up getting the star.
Right.
And because they thought they could control it, I think that was mentioned. But the other choices were leak to David Sanger of the New York Times or Walter Pincus of the Washington Post, have a press conference with Rumsfeld and Rice, and I can't remember the others, but everything dealt with the national media.
Right.
There was nothing that was local.
Well, and that really was a national story, but I'm glad you mentioned the Meet the Press thing. Anybody who's ever, you know, watched Meet the Press knows that you don't control Tim Russert, you don't control Meet the Press. What control the message refers to is long-form conversation, not sliced and diced. Like if Brian Williams came in and sat down for an interview with the vice president, it would be cut up into a package, and there'd be other voices in the story, you know, competing voices in the story. So it wouldn't be, you know, you don't have that long-form opportunity to explain, you know, how you why you did something or how you feel about something. So the reference in that, you know, was about the long-form conversation and the ability to get your story explained in that amount of detail. Other thing, and this is what I referred to when I mentioned the Howie Kurtz book, Spin Cycle. Those strategies were all laid out in that book, and I'm sure if somebody wrote a book about the Johnson administration or the Eisenhower administration, you could have found similar tactics. David Sanger is a guy who knows a lot about foreign policy and so it was, you know, he's New York Times. You know, if you sit down with him a day ahead of time and they make it, do you have a chance to explain your story exclusively to him in a way that's going to be read by a lot of people and set the table for future coverage? Now, they didn't end up choosing that option.
Uh-huh.
But those things were first of all, they're not nefarious. They're kind of time-tested and long-held practices of the trade. And I think it was really the fact that the notion that Kathy's comments and those exhibits pulled the curtain back on this, you know, diabolical, you know, communications machinery was really kind of laughable to me because of having read Spin Cycle, you know, about the Clinton administration and having heard the C-SPAN interview with LBJ and Jack Valenti talking about the same kind of issues in the 60s, I thought that was a little bit of a reach and some overheated rhetoric on that topic.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to some questions. Let's start with a question from Towson. Anybody got a question? Okay, let's take one from California. Yeah.
But it still seemed as though he was prepared beforehand to ask a few certain reporters questions at the beginning. And I'm wondering if that was the case, and if so, why you make the decision to call on certain people first.
He makes the decision on who to call on. You know, now, he looked out and he called on, you know, who he wanted to call on. He had been told ahead of time who was in the pool today, so he knew, you know, that you know, it was Brett Baer and Ed Henry, you know, from Fox and CNN, and he knew David Gregory was there, and he knew Bill Plant was there from CBS, so he wasn't looking for Jim Axelrod. Mm-hmm. You know, he knew Bill Plant was a CBS guy. generally, in that format, he'll call on all the TV correspondents. Usually he'll call on all or two of the three wire correspondents. Today, I believe he got, you know, he often calls on the AP first, which he did today with Jennifer. Mm-hmm. So I don't believe he called on any of the radio people today. So it really just kind of depends. But he kind of picks. He knows who they all are. If there's a new person, usually the press office will flag it for him. You know, somebody is, you know, filling in today or whatever. But you know, that's kind of how that works. People ask me sometimes, does he really know all their names? You know, he does.
But he also has them on a list.
He has, when there's a formal press conference, he'll have a seating chart. So he kind of knows, you know. And really, it's so that, you know, he can make sure he gets to everybody, you know, so that he feels like if you're going to call on Time, you should call on Newsweek. You know, if you're going to call on, you know, two of the TVs, you should call on all of them. Even though it's not, there's no, you know, I don't think it's written down anywhere that it's mandatory. But that's how he kind of manages that.
Uh-huh. Towson? Towson, are you all tuned in?
We lost your video, but we do have still audio.
Okay. Do you have a question then?
There, you're back on video.
You mentioned that the Bush strategy for rapid response is just being offensive. How does this differ from the strategies of other administrations to rapid response?
You know, I think it's a tactic that have been used that has been used on campaigns, I think, for forever and ever and ever. And I think the last Martha, you would know better than me in terms of your analysis of past administrations and how much they emphasize rapid response.
Well, the Clinton administration had a very sophisticated operation right from day one.
Right.
Yeah. And
I think it sprouted from the campaign mentality, but years and years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly has been a long time operation. Here? Somebody?
You started going through your day, and I think you got to about 8:30.
Right.
I was wondering if you could just continue, unless it's, you know, obviously if you're going to have to keep going on and on. But
no, no 2 days are alike. The today was a day with that happened to have a lot of meetings. Some days are like that. Some with the president, some without. As policy, there's always a policy process at the White House, and it works its way through, you know, the various meetings on how we're going to deal with a certain topic. We had a meeting today on the Supreme Court decision, yesterday on the EPA decision, to kind of learn what it's all about and to begin to consider how we're going to, what the best way it will be to, you know, communicate about it. And so there's meetings, there's a lot of phone calls, some with reporters, some with communications people elsewhere in the administration and the White House. One of the things things intervene, and I'm trying to think of an example that I can share. You know, I sat down with Kathy Martin today and we talked about the array of policy issues that are out there right now. There's about 15 of them that are kind of active, some little, some small. We just did a trade deal with Korea. It occurred to me, you know what, I got to get my hands around this. It's very complicated. You know, there's Hill strategy, which always is another, you know, kind of piece. You may know how you're going to talk about it, but you have to kind of balance that with what does the Ledge Affairs Shop say? I mean, how can we most effectively talk about it in the context of the Hill? My day, you know, today was just a meetings day. They're not all like that. But today was some days you spend more time planning, thinking about, you know, what's coming up. We had a meeting on the calendar. To look ahead, we try to plan out 6-8 weeks out. So we look through April and May today about, and this is, the message is really driven by the calendar. You know, where is the president going to be? And then from there, you kind of fill in the cabinet and other surrogates, White House staffers. So we kind of mapped out today. You know, and the way it works, you know that, you know, every week you're going to do something on Iraq, and then you kind of try to bunch together you know, energy, education, healthcare, whatever the issues are, linked up with what's going on the Hill, so that it makes some sense and that you can drive the agenda, so that you're just not doing an energy event for the sake of doing an energy event. So that was a lot of today. Today was a lot of meetings on policy stuff and then some planning, you know, the calendar ahead. But there's always things that pop up that you didn't anticipate.
Are the morning meetings tend to be internal ones, and then the afternoon meetings are more external?
Generally, I think generally that's true. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a report coming out of Brussels on Friday about global warming. And so at the end of the day, it was like midnight in Belgium. We got together the communicator who's there, just to kind of make sure everybody was on the same wavelength. What was what's in this report, and how are we going to respond to it? And you know, so that was something that kind of got added. I did this radio interview that was added during the day. Hey, can you do this? You know, again, trying to push on the supplemental this Iraq funding issue.
At the end of the day, do you bring all the communications people together?
You know, it's at the end of the day, it's really more done by email and phone. You know, I try to leave around 7. Usually it's closer to 7:30, you know, so I get home about 8 o'clock. So, I leave at 6 a.m. and get home at 8 and love every minute of it in between. Try not to mess anything up. You know, the stakes are high, you know. I mean, kind of representing the president, leader of the free world, trying to let the, you know, the. But, you know, it's funny because it's not as stressful or it's a great environment to be a part of. I know I've said that 3 times. Mm-hmm. President's energy level is amazing, and he keeps things fun and staff, you know, kind of fired up, and it's, you know.
How many times?
That keeps you going.
How many times, say, a week would you talk to the president?
You know, it varies. Sometimes a lot, and sometimes not. You know, I've had the privilege of traveling quite a bit with the president, and that is another layer. You know, in terms of as you're planning your travel, if you can work it out, I recommend Air Force One. You know, saves a lot of time. Those motorcades, you know, you come and go pretty fast. You know, but, you know, usually at some point during the day, not every single day, but usually at some point I'll be in a meeting or, you know, a briefing or an interview or something with the president.
Uh-huh. Okay. Towson?
What role does public opinion on certain issues influence which issues the White House focuses on?
What was the beginning part about public opinion?
What kind of role does public opinion on certain issues influence which issues the White House focuses on?
You know, it's a good question. Thank you for that. Sometimes people accuse the president, and I think this is true of any president. He's in a bubble, you know. He's insulated. He's isolated. Not true. You know, the president knows what's going on. The people who work there know what's going on. And public opinion... it's interesting because it does play a part, and yet one of the hallmarks, I think, of the president's leadership style and management style is that he makes decisions based on principle, not popularity. Look no farther than the war in Iraq. I'll take just 1 minute to say that the president has a unique ability, and I think when you watch the 08 campaign unfold, you're going to see candidates shift with the news of the day and with popular opinion and with polls and kind of what's in the paper in the morning. You kind of the old, you know, you sort of lick your finger and you see which way is the wind is blowing or what's in the paper. The president has this unique ability to really take the long view. So while we don't dismiss public opinion, you can't change your core beliefs or your principles because of it. And again, all these cool jobs that I've had, you know, I've had the ability, the opportunity to be around some really great leaders. And even though I didn't work for Mark Cuban, everybody always asks me about Mark Cuban with the Mavericks. He has a really, really effective leadership style for where he is and what his mission is. Obviously, he couldn't pull that off in the White House. And the hardest thing, I think, to do in the White House is to take the long view in the face of this crazy media cycle we've been talking about, the blogs, the polls, 3 polls a day, opposition in the Democratic Party and on the Hill, so easy to shift. And yet, you know, the president has said, you know, last year he read three books on George Washington. That was 42 presidents ago. They're still writing books about him. He believes that the history of our time will be written not next year or in the 08 election cycle or even 10 years from now, but more like 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now. And he believes that based on the intelligence that he gets every day and that there are people out there that want to hurt us and in the interest of our children and grandchildren, this is the right thing to do. And he knows it's unpopular, and he knows that it's upsetting. He meets with the families of the fallen all the time. He will again tomorrow in California. So when we talk about what impact does public opinion have, it has an impact. Certain policy issues probably more than others. Definitely we're aware of how people feel about things. But on the topic of the big issues, immigration is another one. You know, you don't change your core beliefs. Immigration is one that we wrestle with within our own party, you know, because of one constituency or one poll or one, you know, whatever it might be. So I don't know if that answers the question exactly, but I think it's an interesting thing about working for this president at this time is his ability to keep the long view in the face of divergent views.
When you look at polls, like say in the Clinton administration, one of the polls that was particularly important to them was how people looked at their lives and where the country was going.
Right.
Whether things are better or whether they're worse. Do you all look at those? Does the president look at those?
President, I've never heard the president talk about, you know, show me this poll or what about that poll. You know, the interesting is, you know, the political experts will tell you the country is about, you know, 45% Democratic and 45% Republican and 10% Independent. And the one thing I look at when I see the polls is what was the breakdown of the sample? And sometimes it'll be 25% Republican or 35% Republican, you know, and I think you kind of look for some of those, mm-hmm. you know, signals in the polling. On Iraq, I mean, there are polls that you see, right direction, wrong direction, and those have changed a little bit lately. I think with General Petraeus now, having been on the ground a couple of months now, and that, you know, as the new strategy is beginning to we won't know much for another few months, but I think there's early indications that, you know, things have turned a little bit for the better. So, you know, you can't get too wrapped up in them. You really can't.
But on the other hand, they're telling you what the public feels.
They're telling you what that sample felt based on a certain question asked in a certain way. So I think you really need to drill down and see what were they asked, when were they asked, who was asked, you know. But you don't dismiss it. I mean, you just can't change your core beliefs based on it. I think it'd be the main thing I would say to that.
But wouldn't polls also be important for selling a program? You want to know what people think, and so you look at a poll and see what their perceptions are.
I think it could be one ingredient. I think it could be a helpful, informative thing, as long as the sample was, you know, mm-hmm. was fair, and the question wasn't pushing an answer in a certain direction, and those kind of things.
I guess kind of on the point of polling, my question is, well, if you don't see polls, you know, polls obviously, as you indicated, aren't going to change the president's policy, but do they change your policy as a communications director? Because, you know, if you're believing in the policy and the public isn't believing in the policy, then clearly, you know, maybe you're not doing as good of a job communicating that policy to the public.
It's a great question. And in fact, I can use a Dallas Mavericks example, and then I'll use a White House example. In 1995, I guess it was, or 6, the Dallas Mavericks traded Jason Kidd. Bad move. Bad move. All the years I was there, probably the most fun I had was the Jason Kidd Rookie of the Year campaign. He ended up sharing the award with Grant Hill. We had this tooth and nail kind of pitched battle with the Detroit Pistons against Grant Hill to try to get Jason Kidd the award. And we had the strategy mapped out. There was a full-blown campaign. I mean, it was a great thing. really fun thing to be a part of. And team was sold year and a half later or whatever. Things weren't going well. And the new coach wanted to trade Jason Kidd. Well, I didn't think it was a good idea, but it really, my opinion, you know, was of no consequence. My job was to represent the ownership and the management of the team. So I went to the coach, you know, why did we make this deal? Help me sell this. But I was also a team guy, and I knew that I needed to be on board with this. So I had to set aside my personal views and you know, develop a way to explain why this made sense. Now, the Mavericks did in that deal get Michael Finley, who went on to become a multiple-time All-Star. You know, my guy here shake his head.
No, Michael
no, I'm not. However, you know, you do the best that you can. Now, fast forward to, and the same would be said at NBC or the White House. When you, and I don't know how many of you guys are going to end up interested in communications or want to study communications as a career, but you have an obligation to yourself and to your boss to raise your hand and give your opinion, whether it's the President of the United States or the President of the Dallas Mavericks, to say, why are we doing this? And you give your opinion, and you give your opinion in the most, you know, fact-based, not that you can't inject emotion into it, because you feel strongly about it, but make your case. Sell your position. But then if you get outvoted, you gotta be on board, you know? And that's sort of how it works at the White House. You know, and I told myself, you know, when I came to the White, there's all these Ivy League guys. I went to Purdue. I'm a state school guy. You know, I'm some guy that was doing arena football and NASCAR a few years ago. Here I am in the White House. But I also know that the skills translate, and I trust my instincts, and I believe I have good judgment. And I am, even though there's all these Ivy League smart guys, you know, I can do this, or else they wouldn't have asked me to come to the White House. So I am never going to bite my tongue. I'm not going to hold back if I really believe, you know, that I have something to offer on a topic or something that I really believe the president, you know, should know about. And I've really been true to that. I haven't always been right. My views haven't always been accepted, but I haven't held back, because if I held back, you know, and something went wrong, like if I didn't raise an issue for the president, like if I knew Bill Plant from CBS, one thing was really on his mind was, I'm trying to think what he asked today, but let's say that I knew.
Yeah, I was in Baltimore. I missed it.
Let's say I knew that he was going to ask about Speaker Pelosi's trip to Syria. And, you know, and for whatever reason, I didn't feel confident enough in my information that I didn't raise it. And then the president was asked the question and didn't answer it the way that would make, you know, the best answer or whatever. You know, I would have not served the president well by holding back. And the same is true with that Jason Kidd trade or whatever. If you're in a communications position, advocate for your position. But if you end up losing out, you got to be on board, because your job is to represent, you know, the company that you work for or the candidate or whoever it might be, you know. And I think once you've had a chance to speak your mind and give your view, even when you get outvoted, it's, you know, you can accept. But if you bite your tongue, you'll never feel good about it, you know, based on my experience. Because I have, you know, I have held back a time or two and regretted it.
Uh-huh.
But not in a long time, though.
Okay, let's go to Towson, and we'll come with you and then you. Towson?
You had mentioned a few times that you had learned a few things from listening to the LBJ tapes. I don't know, you just mentioned it. But the Bush administration had passed a directive that allows the president, like, not to release his presidential papers and stuff. Don't you think it's important for the public to have access to these archival records for historical purposes, like, well, just like you kind of learned?
Yeah, there is a Presidential Records Act. We didn't pass a, you know, I forget how you worded it, but we didn't do anything against the notion that there didn't need to be presidential papers made available. It had to do with classified information and national security matters and that sort of thing. But there is a timetable where all this stuff does get made public, and it is fascinating to go back. And we believe, you know, as an administration, strongly that's important for scholars to be, you know, who knows what they're gonna find 12 years from now when all the emails and the papers are put on display. You know, I plan on, you know, I'll go check it out to see what kind of things I said or wrote, you know, in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
I think the tape recorder got taken out after Watergate, but
those were very, they were very effective in giving an idea of how a president operated, and that one of the experiences in presidential libraries is that the fuller the president's records are, the more likely he is to get a different shake from history, that the first cut of history can be unkind, which is reporting. If there are really a lot of records, then they get another look. That was the case with Eisenhower, that Eisenhower was seen as a hands-off kind of guy, but when his papers came out, he was seen in another way. What happened in this administration was there was an executive order. They issued an executive order at the end of 2001 that dealt with confidential advice records, and that those records have to come through with the White House for review. Yeah.
I actually have two questions. First of all, I was interested when you went through the newspapers you read in the morning. I mean, you must be a very fast reader and drink lots of coffee to get through all of that.
Diet Coke.
But I was wondering if it's true. I had heard that with this current administration that the subscription to The Guardian was canceled, and I noticed in your list there were no foreign newspapers. So I'm just wondering, do you ever read newspapers like Le Monde or The Guardian or the Yomiuri or the Asahi or the Japan Times or the Sydney Morning Herald, any of the international press, given the importance of U.S. policy on the lives of ordinary people all over the planet?
Right.
That's question number one.
Why don't we answer that one first and then come to the other?
I don't know the answer.
He said Financial Times. He did say Financial Times.
I don't know the answer to the Guardian question, so I can't help you there. And in terms of the foreign newspapers, leading up to and during and right after a foreign trip, I'd be more likely to online. Mm-hmm. But day in and day out, it's not something that I've done. We do have someone in the media affairs that does, but I don't personally. Maybe it's something I should do more. I mean, I'll take that as a good suggestion. You know, and in terms of reading that many papers, I have a system. I used to read. I spent my whole life since I was 5 years old reading the sports section first, and now I usually read the sports section last at night at home usually. But what I try to do is, I'll take the Post, and we get a digest. Martha has seen this. We do get a news summary that is available at 7:30, which I can kind of double back through that and look for other things like the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune. I'll see what's kind of digested in there for us. But basically, I read the front page and the jumps from the front page and the editorial page, and I know in the Post you got to read page three, and you got to read what used to be the Federal page, which is now the In the Loop. And USA Today, I'll read down the rails of each of the money section, and I'll go to the editorial page there, and so I have a kind of a speed reading technique. And then as I see things that I want to read in more detail, I set them aside. And I'll try to take a crack at them. The White House is an eat lunch at your desk kind of place, and so sometimes while I'm scarfing down a sandwich, I'll flip through something that I set aside. And then if I don't get it there, it goes in the bag, and I'll try to look at it before I go to bed at night. So it's sort of an ongoing flow chart of trying to get to it all. But I do that kind of rip through with each of the papers, some in differently than others.
The news summary has, over the years, gotten longer and longer. Some of them that I was looking at, but if you take it from beginning to end, it's about 175 pages. And what kind of system do you have for going through it?
Well, what will happen is in the senior staff meeting, like Eddie Lazier, the economic guru, sometimes he'll say, there's a great article today in in the Financial Times, for example, about this. He'll have something that I never would have gotten on my first pass through. So I'll note that in the summary. I always look through that, and then I read the summaries, and then I'll mark the ones I need to go back and read the whole story if I missed it on my first cut. But by the time I've heard Dana Perino and senior staff, and by the time we've had our 8 o'clock communicators meeting, usually every article that has something to do with us has been mentioned by somebody. And so I try to keep that 8:30 to 9 o'clock, you know, free so that we've had these two meetings. I can kind of take a step back. There's very little time to think, you know, in the course of the day. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like I did a real good job answering your question about what happens during the day because, you know, it seems like it's more of a breakneck pace than meetings and talking about planning, but I'm going to think about that, you know, a better way to answer it next time.
Okay, you had your second question.
Second question. Several times in the course of your responses, you have alluded to believing in the cause as the reason why you joined this particular administration. And since you're good at communicating, I wonder if you could just summarize what you consider to be the cause in a few sentences. And as a sort of second part of the question, before you took on the job, did you in your own mind, and maybe this is too personal to answer, but I'm wondering if you had in your own mind any thought of, if things go a certain way, I will no longer do this job because ethically I couldn't continue being a communicator for that kind of policy? Or do you feel that your job is to communicate as best as you can whatever is this administration's point of view, no matter what it is?
You know, two great questions. I believe in the president. When I talk about believing in the cause, it's bigger than it encompasses a few things. Number one, the work is important. And as much as I love sports, and sports is important in a different way, like in my NBC days, it was great. It was hard work. It was stressful. It was fun. There were ups and downs. But I always was aware that it was not important, really. I mean, like I would have arguments over the phone at home with reporters about ratings. And my wife used to say, do people really care about this? Do they even put this stuff in the paper? And I would say, yeah, there's all these columnists that all they'd write about is TV ratings. And I just had this sense that it wasn't that fulfilling or meaningful. As much as it was fun and as much as I enjoyed being a part of this, you know, NBC Universal thing, and 30 Rock was a great building to go to work to every day, a lot of smart people and everything. So the first thing that appealed to me is this has impact. This has meaning. And you know, we're talking about education and healthcare and all the issues that I've talked about. Now, when it comes to the president, I absolutely believe in him and the vision that he has and keeping my children and my grandchildren safe and doing things that will, I believe the president is 100% right on the need for comprehensive immigration reform. You know, I happen to believe in his policies. Now, when I was in New York, I co-taught a class at NYU. With an adjunct. I was not really an adjunct because I never taught before, so I was sort of under his wing. But I really taught this class virtually by myself for a semester. And the first night, I didn't know what to expect. I hadn't been in a classroom in 20 whatever years. And the first night, this young woman sitting in the second row, we're kind of doing communications 101 as an overview for a class on media strategies. So the very first night, I'm going through all this stuff, and she says, "Has anybody ever asked you to lie?" And I was floored. And I thought, man, this is going to be a great class if on the first night, I get this kind of question. And I said, I've never been asked. I've been asked this sort of thing. Why don't you just tell them that we did this, or why don't you just say that? You know, not necessarily a bald-faced lie, but kind of, And of course, I wouldn't do it. I've never been asked anything like that in my time in the administration, not even close. But what I said to that woman that night is, no, I haven't been asked to lie. And she said, well, what if you did? And I said, I wouldn't do it. And if you ever, in your career, get asked by somebody as a communicator, just tell them whatever this thing is that they want you to make up, you have to say, first of all, I can't do that. I'm not willing to do that. I'm not going to do that. And then you start looking for a job. Because if you don't believe in the people that you work for, it's over. And you just know when it's time to leave, and you know when it, and it's really the best thing about working at the White House. I believe that if everybody in this room, I've had this happen to me where we've had a briefing with the president or a meeting with an outside group or a round table on some topic, and people have said, I didn't vote for him, but if the election were tomorrow, I would. And we hear all the time, I heard it today after the press conference. Somebody sent me an email. If everybody could see this whole thing, his approval rating would be 50%. And that happens all the time. And I know that not everybody can see the things that I see and that sort of thing. But I do, you know, believe in the person and his vision and what he stands for and what he believes in, and it's almost like, you know, anybody, like when I worked for the Mavericks, there were years where we won, where we made the playoffs and went to the conference finals, and there were years when we had some of the worst records in NBA history, and you know what? It's anybody can go be the PR director. The Dallas Mavericks right now don't need a PR director. They're going to win almost 70 games. They just, you know, they have a 9-game winning streak. They lose a game, they win 12. They lose a game, they win 11. They lose a game, they won 16 or whatever it was. Of course, when they came to Washington, they got close to me, they lost. I'm the jinx, I guess. But your real, your mettle is tested, and your abilities as a communicator and your abilities, you know, your core principles, you know, are tested when it's not popular and when times are tough and when, and it's almost like, you know, anybody can do this job. I'm exaggerating when it comes to the White House, but with the Mavericks, you know, it's easy to do when they're going to win 68 games, and you know, but let's, you know, you really get tested when the team is, you know, 15 and 67. You know, the, in the 90s, the Dallas Mavericks were the, I think, had the second worst record of any pro team for the decade of the 90s. So my deal in the 90s was Jason Kidd, Rookie of the Year. You know, or, and there were, and you know what? We took the charity foundation, and we, you know, we did other things, you know, that we, there was a, there was an ownership change. There were other communications challenges. We had a player get banned from the league, banned for life from the league twice. It's hard to get banned for life, but try getting banned twice for life. So to me, you know, that's how I answer the bell every morning. You know, is I know it's important, and I know there's a responsibility. And I would, as young people, I would tell you a couple of things, not to get on the soapbox, Martha, but if I may, you know, you're still young enough that, you know, you can dictate what your life is going to be like, the kind of choices that you make. When I had the opportunity to go to the Department of Education, I had a buddy of mine call me in Dallas and say, you know, I envy you because I couldn't get that job because I had a felony DWI conviction, you know, years and years and years before. You know, I think the choices that you make do have an impact on what kind of life you're going to end up having as young people. And when you have choices, you're going to get offered jobs where you can make a lot of money. You know, I work at a place where everybody who works there can make more money doing something else. There's not one person that's there for the money. You know, that's what really what I was talking about. They believe in whether it's the, you know, the president or, you know, you know, or what we're, the work that we're doing, you know, and really it comes down to the president. And but, you know, when you have those, look at, hopefully you can spend at least part of your career doing something that's important and meaningful that you believe in, no matter what it is, you know, and I think you will, you know, I hate getting, I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, this is really unusual for me to be like this, I go to bed before my kids, you know. And but I don't. I know that I'm doing it for, you know, for a reason, because I want to be awake during the day. You know, last night I stayed up to watch the end of the game. You know, and I went to bed at 11:30. And I, you know, and today, you know, I paid for it a little bit, but not that bad. It's not like I stayed up till 3 o'clock in the morning.
I think that game ended before the end.
11:30. You know, it did. But I wanted to see the end, and I wanted to, you know, see the celebration and all that stuff.
Yeah. Towson. Let's take one more from Towson, and then we have one in the back here. That will be
now it. You got me all wound up.
You mentioned blogs several times.
Right.
Do you, as a communications director, think about blogs and your strategy, and do you personally read any blogs?
Yes, I do. We think about blogs every day. It's a tricky thing because some blogs are one guy with an opinion, but they, there's a tricky thing with blogs in that the same ground rules don't apply as do to journalists. Is really where I was going with that. So your approach is a little bit different, but they are mighty and powerful and to be taken seriously. And any communications person who doesn't include them in their plan is missing the boat. You know, one of the things that Tony Snow likes to do on the job is we would set up blogger calls for him. I cruise through the political blogs on both sides of the aisle, news blogs. One of my favorite blogs is TVNewser.com or .org, maybe it is. It's through Media Bistro. I started.
It is run by a student
at Towson. Right. I was going to mention that. And when I was at NBC, and I'll think of his name in a minute.
Brian Stelter.
Brian Stelter was 19, I think, when we first. And it was a woman who was the VP of Communications at CNBC who proclaimed one day, this guy is to be taken seriously, and we should be talking to him. And the executives were very nervous. It was kind of like, well, just don't let on. Don't let, you know. But he does a great job with that thing. He gets great access. All the executives now talk to him. And he was really the first guy where it occurred to me, this guy should be taken seriously. I still go there almost every, not definitely every week, probably every other day or every third day. And where they can have impact is that opinion leaders and reporters go to these sites so that even if some have bigger followings than others, but the good ones have the right kind of following that could be impactful. And so we monitor them all the time. Our rapid response people keep an eye on it because that's where you see sometimes where this misinformation can mm-hmm. can catch, you know, like wildfire. Mm-hmm. And good information, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the back, that's our last question.
Thanks for coming out. And I don't know which one's more controversial, the political questions or the Dallas Mavericks trade decisions.
Yeah.
But my question is, can you just break it down for me? The biggest differences and similarities between the work that you did in the business sector
right.
versus what you do in the political sector.
Okay. First of all, on the one last thing on the sports politics angle, and this is probably the best thing about it. And a minute ago, I was talking about do something, be a part of something you can believe in and you care about. Well, sports inflames passions like almost nothing else. And it's really fun to be a part of something that people care about so intensely. And you know, politics is the same way. Governing is the same way. There's impassioned feelings. I love being around people who care about something much more than the people that are kind of like a dial tone and don't care and aren't engaged and all that. So that's another similarity is the passions that kind of flow. Now, working at NBC Universal, let's take my last job there when I was a senior VP of Media Relations and Corporate Communications. So under that, I had CNBC and MSNBC and Telemundo and a whole corporate communications, mm-hmm. you know, department that had other sub-tentacles. Now, on the West Coast, we were involved in, now this didn't report directly to me, but I was involved in them every day. We met via conference call. You're in the movie business, the TV studio business, the television network business, the theme park business, of course, out of Orlando. The I don't know if I mentioned home entertainment, and on and on and on and on and on and on. So if something would happen, like, for example, let's say you were going to make a change with an executive at CNBC. You had human resources involved. You had CNBC involved. You had the guy who was in charge of CNBC. Okay, let's count him as CNBC. You had the person who was in charge of the cable business. Mm-hmm. You had all of them had communications people. You had corporate people from NBC involved, depending on how high up it was going to go. My point being that bureaucracy at NBC Universal is every bit as difficult to navigate as the U.S. government bureaucracy. So when people talk about it, we couldn't get a statement cleared. It took all day. You had lawyers involved. I left them out. You know, general counsel's office. So when people say about the first thing you always hear about is that the bureaucracy and the government. Sure, there's a government bureaucracy that often has systemic problems and doesn't always function. Well, the same can be said in the corporate world, especially at a big company. You're going to have multiple layers, and the approval process is unwieldy, and it will drive you nuts as a communications person. So that's a similarity. One difference, I would say, NBC, when I was in the corporate job, they've announced that Jeff Zucker is taking over as the chairman and CEO of the company. Bob Wright has been there for over 20 years, did a great job leading the company through this time of change in the media world. Well, it was when I was there, it was interesting in that the jockeying was still kind of going on to see who was going to be Bob's successor. And so when we did, you know, media, you know, there was always a little bit of tension about, not bad, and these were all good people and smart people and everything, but there was that element of, is this good for me to be in this story or not? You know, why am I the only guy in the story? Why am I in this story or not in this story? And I think, and I'm singling out NBC because I was there at that time, and this is a well-documented, Bill Carter of the New York Times wrote a book called Desperate Networks that included this kind of stuff in it. That is also, if you're interested in the television racket, it's a terrific book. But the reason I bring it up is that I went from that to the Department of Education and then to the White House. And nobody at the White House or at the U.S. Department of Education is pulling communicators aside saying, you know, I really need you to get me in some stories because I want to go be the, you know, Deputy Secretary of the Interior, and I need more pub to get there, so you got to help me out. Can you get me a story in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal? Just does not happen. Because it's not about, you know, if you're a policy guy at the White House and you want to go to some bigger job, it just doesn't happen. I mean, that element of self-promotion is just not in the equation, in my experience. It's about the president. It's about the goals of the administration. It's about, you know, these issues that we're dealing with that affect so many people. That's why we're there, because if we didn't care about those things, we'd be somewhere else, you know? So I think that's a big difference. It's not about me phenomenon. And one thing that where it really struck me, we were interviewing for a position at when I was at education to bring on a communications person, and she was from she was not from the administration, but she was from she was in D.C. but not in the administration. And she started to ask these kind of questions like, what's my title going to be, and where's my office, and am I going to have a window, and how many people are going to report to me, and all this kind of stuff. And to me, Kevin, these were all perfectly reasonable questions. You know, I always would tell people you have to advocate for yourself, you know, because if you don't, nobody else will. So when you're interviewing for a job, you got to find out, what am I going to make, and what is the reporting structure, and, you know, those are all very reasonable questions. But in the administration, you know, I could just kind of read the body language of the other people in the meeting that, you know, it's all about her. Doesn't she know it's not all about us here? You know, that's not why we're here. It's just a different mindset. It's fascinating. And many people that are in the administration were very accomplished before they got to the administration and now are doing this, or they're kind of on the way up. They're young in their careers and they're going to do this first. And then they're going to go into the private sector or whatever. You know, I mean, different people are in different timelines with different goals. But that's probably the biggest difference, is the mindset is more, you know, a little bit, you know, the mindset is just a little bit different, I would say. And there are other differences and other similarities, but I think the two biggest that I would point to are those two that I just went through.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.